going to turn to Yaw's testimony. There was an interesting discussion in our in a chat room. There is not a specific chat room at this point associated with the Genesis Communication Networks, as there are with other programs that do stream online. But a number of individuals who have over the years listened to the programs that I've produced on Blog Talk Radio have created a Skype chat room that is active during this show. If, for example, if you'd like to participate in that chat room, I would suggest going to the forum that is posted on Yada Yah. Go to yadayah.com. Click on the upper right-hand corner. There's a link to the forum. It's free. It's anonymous. And in that forum, you'll find how to participate in this Skype chat room if that's something that you'd like to do. Well, anyway, in the Skype chat room yesterday, we were talking. There were two individuals, two very well-informed individuals, two men who I've gotten to know quite well through the years, that were discussing a difference of opinion related to the timing of Yah's festival feast. And because today's program is going to be focused on matzah, they were having a discussion as to whether or not the Passover meal should be consumed on the beginning of Passover, which would be Passover begins, the 14th day begins at sunset of the 13th day and concludes at sunset on the 14th day. For example, if you were to consume the Passover meal after sunset on the 14th day, you would be eating it on the 15th day. And so they were having a discussion in that light, because you have this whole indication with Yahusha where he said that he wanted to enjoy the Passover meal with his disciples, and in that year the sundown on the 13th day, which is the beginning of the 14th day, was a Thursday. He had the meal then with his disciples, and he became the Passover lamb that same day, but the next day by modern reckoning of time, as opposed to the Hebrew day, which begins at sunset and ends at sunset. And so they were having a discussion as to when would what's the best time to consume the lamb? And they were having another discussion of how many days do we eat unleavened bread? Does the 7 days commence with the day of unleavened bread, or does it commence with Passover, where we are instructed to eat unleavened bread? And then a number of other issues on timing. So let me read to you what I responded to that chat room discussion yesterday, because I think it is it helps to frame an issue that is important to me. And I think an issue that is important to Yahweh. This is my response. The discussion in the chat room yesterday, now today, well, then today, now yesterday, was mostly about timing, which is the one thing that I think, by design, cannot be absolutely resolved. Two informed, rational people, for example, came to different conclusions yesterday. The reasons are many, I suspect. First, Yahusha had to eat and celebrate Passover with his disciples before being sacrificed as the Passover lamb. This is the reason, I suspect, that the scriptural days begin at sunset and end at sunset. And it is the reason that, personally, I choose to eat Passover at the beginning of the 14th day, which is sunset at the end of the 13th day. Yahusha referred to this as the time to observe the Passover meal. Now, so I've shared that. That's my conclusion, but I want to make it really clear that I don't think it is possible by design to know for certain and to say for absolute certain that somebody who has a different view is wrong and that my conclusion is right. I would never go there. There are things I think you can tell for absolute certain. In fact, most things in Yah's testimony you can know for absolute certain. I don't think this is one of them. And I think there's a reason for that. All right, I went on to say, second, Yah is far more interested in us coming to know, to understand, and to accept his invitations to meet with him than he is with us doing something on the right date. And based upon your discussion, this individual, the two people who are having a discussion, their first names were James and Chuck. We all concur on this point, that God is far more interested in us responding to that which we understand than he is to us just doing something robotically. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to figure out the time of the meeting, but I don't think we will be able to say for sure, at least not before Yom Kippurim in 6000 Yah when Yah returns. Now, third, Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. Pesach is the first event as it relates to our path to God and our salvation. Matzah is the second, probably the most important, and Bikurim is the third. I say Matzah is the most important. Even Yahweh agrees with me, and I say it because Yahweh says the same thing. He even referred to this collective of these three dates as unleavened bread, as matzah. But they are a cohesive unit. They are inseparable. It is one event. Pesach, matzah, and Bikurim are one event. If this were a wedding, it would be the rehearsal dinner, the ceremony, and the reception. One event. With the mikre, at least among the first three or four of them, one without the other has no lasting value. You know, what good is it to be perfect, which is the benefit of matzah, and yet still being mortal, which is the benefit of Pesach? What good is it to be immortal, to benefit from Pesach, and still be imperfect, the benefit of matzah? You know, if you're immortal and imperfect, you're going to spend your eternity in Sheol. Why would someone want to be reborn spiritually if not into the covenant? In other words, you take advantage of Pesach and Matzah, but don't take advantage of Bikurim, where you are adopted into God's family, his covenant family. Why be adopted if you're not going to grow, which is the benefit of Shavuah, the fourth Moed Mikre? Now, I said I am probably contributing to the potential for confusion here because I have a tendency to emphasize the unique purpose of each event when in reality it is only when they are observed collectively, with each Mikre making its contribution, that we receive the intended benefit. There's a reason that Yahweh enabled the first four Mikre, all in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE on our pagan calendars, all in one year. Because any one of the four without all four isn't useful. It gets back to understanding. You understand when you put the pieces together, when you make connections. Well, these four things are connected. They are all fulfilled collectively because collectively they enable the benefits of the covenant. Now, and in this regard, I continue to write, Shavuah should not be disassociated from the initial celebration, because without it, we are not enriched or empowered and thus do not grow. So while I have my ideas on when and why, what really matters is that we all individually and collectively look to Yahweh's Torah for understanding and guidance. We are always rewarded when we do so. Such is the case with your discussion. Also, as is in the case with observational or astronomical determination of the timing, some people prefer to look out in the sky and see when they can observe the first sliver of a new moon. Some people prefer to look at the astronomical calculations that tell us when the first sliver of a new moon will appear. And so what I'm saying is that no matter which of those you choose, or a combination of both, no matter how a person interprets Yah's instruction, they will seldom be more than a day off, one day early or late. And that's really the margin of error here is one day versus the next. This year, do you celebrate Pesach beginning on Monday evening next week or on Tuesday evening? That's really the wiggle room that exists here. And Scripture tells us that 2 weeks late didn't bother Yahweh a bit. Hezekiah is the example. When the Assyrians were barreling down on them, Hezekiah wanted to celebrate Passover, but he couldn't get the temple cleared of religious rubbish. He couldn't get the land cleared of religious artifacts. And quickly enough, he couldn't get people educated as to so that they would understand what they were doing quickly enough. And he asked Yahweh, hey, can I have a two-week extension, and can we celebrate Passover 2 weeks late? He said, absolutely. Because why? Because understanding is more important than the timing. So as you can tell, I did not engage in your discussion over timing. Both of you articulated your conclusions very well. You evidenced them. You rationalized them as well as can be done. It was like two brothers having a discussion over their father's instructions. You could both be right. But the very fact that you turned to the Torah for answers means that neither of you can be wrong. Now we have Glenn calling in on from Philadelphia with a question about other Hebrew writings, I think specifically regarding the Talmud. Hello, Glenn. Welcome to the program.
Hello, yeah, I've been listening to you on and off for a number of weeks. I've called me once before. I myself, I'm a Christian, so just sort of a goy background. I find myself pretty much in agreement with the vast majority of what you said. Great appreciation for your command of Hebrew and your commitment to the Torah. And that's the thing, as an English-speaking Christian who has just a very little bit of background in Hebrew from, I did a Bachelor of Arts degree in Biblical Studies, a minor in psychology, and started in seminary. So I have just enough Hebrew and Greek under my belt to be a annoying, but I have great appreciation, you know, for the etymological work you do and the stuff that you say. My only concern is, you know, I want to make sure that God is accessible to people who don't have the understanding of, you know, the Hebrew calendar, you know, and the Torah and that sort of thing. I wouldn't want to put up a linguistic barrier.
Let's be clear here. We're going to have to answer this question at the other side of the commercial. But I will shatter a myth if I might. You don't have to be an expert in Hebrew to understand God's teaching, and there is really no such thing as a Hebrew calendar. So when we return to Shattering Myths, hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Glenn calling in from Philadelphia. He had two issues. One was to wanted to know whether or not Yah's instructions were available to everyone in terms of understanding them, or was understanding Hebrew a barrier to understanding and having access to God's testimony. And the second was being able to understand the Hebrew calendar. So let me deal with the first one. God does not want it to be easy. He has no interest in somebody taking a shortcut and saying, you know, I'm interested in knowing God, but only if there's a Cliff Notes version, if there's a summary, if there's a Bill Bright had a thing in Christianity called the Four Spiritual Laws, and he gave somebody a track, and he said, you know, if you deal with these four spiritual laws, then you're saved. Billy Graham said, just come forward and you have a sinner's prayer, and if it's easy, yeah, then count me in. Yeah, I don't want to go to hell anyway, so count me in. That's not God's style. He doesn't want anybody to spend eternity with him in his home that isn't genuinely interested in getting to know him as he really is and forming a relationship with him based upon the specifics of what he's offering. And so God has made it challenging by design. There is no little shortcut that I can say, you know, if you just do these things, you're saved. It's not that way. God doesn't want it that way. He doesn't want it to be easy. Yeah, he only wants people to spend eternity with him who are willing to invest the time. Now, that being said, the most prolific document, ancient document in all of human history, by far, is the Torah. There is nothing that comes even close to the Torah in terms of numbers of ancient manuscripts of it. Now, in terms of understanding it in the original language, that is a challenge. And it's a challenge primarily because the religious publishing companies that translate and publish Bibles, which is an errant pagan term, have an agenda, and they are purposefully misleading. And so it is very difficult to come to know Yahweh as he is and embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant and observe his annual invitations to meet with him based solely upon English translations, because they are all rotten. They are very misleading. And as it relates to the covenant scriptures, they're probably errant to the degree of about 50%. 50% through a combination of they use the wrong basis. The Masoretic is opposed to the Dead Sea Scrolls. They translated a word errantly, or they translated a word inadequately. And if it relates to this myth of the Christian New Testament, it isn't even 10% accurate. But there's a whole host of issues with that that are very different than the Torah prophets and Psalms. Now, as it relates to Hebrew, I wrote a book. I wrote it actually for my son that I made public, that is available to you free. If you go to intro, I-N-T-R-O, to T-O, God, G-O-D, .org, introtogod.org, you're going to find a 1,200-page book. That book was specifically designed to provide you, Glenn, with the tools that are required to understand Yah's testimony as he revealed it in Hebrew. You're not going to need any of your college education. Now, all it does is provide you with the tools. It explains the sources that we have, the oldest sources of Yah's testimony. It explains the language that they were written in, even the letters that comprised that language and the meaning of those letters. It describes the vowels and the consonants. It describes the stems, which show relationships between subjects and objects with regard to the action of the verbs. It talks about the two ways to deal with conjugations, the perfect and the imperfect, as well as the moods, which are emotionally volitional. And then it goes into an in-depth analysis of the terms and names that are most important to understand. And then after it provides all the tools that you'll need to do this on your own and to verify what you're reading on your own, so that you get in practice of doing it, it goes through the seven topics that are most important to God, the seven things God most wants you to know. And it uses those very tools to focus on those seven topics so that you get to use these tools that you have been given to process these topics that are so important to your understanding and how you participate in the covenant and how you walk to God and are saved by the path that he has provided, with matzah, the day that we're talking about, being first among them. Now, we also have Rod on the phone calling in from Indiana, but after this commercial break, Glenn, I'm going to address the second point that you raised as it relates to the Hebrew calendar, and then we're going to turn our attention to Rod and to his question. Hello, welcome back to Shattering This. We've got Glenn on the phone calling in from Philadelphia. Glenn had questions, one about the accessibility of understanding the Torah based upon the fact that it is written in Hebrew, and to understand it, one has to examine the words as they were written in Hebrew. And I shared with him that there is a tool provided called introtogod.org that provides those tools. They are also available free online. There are many interlinears, many lexicons that are available free online, as well as very powerful programs like the Logos program that can expedite one's quest to understand. The second thing I wanted to address quickly here before we go to Rockland is this notion of a Hebrew calendar. There really is no Hebrew calendar. Now, there is a rabbinic calendar, but the rabbinic calendar is irrelevant to the things of God, and the Hebrew calendar, the rabbinic calendar, is usually wrong. God lays out his calendar for us in his Torah. So he tells us when the first month of the year is. It's Abib, and he tells us how to identify the first month of the year based upon barley and the flowering of the flax. He tells us that it's the renewing light on the moon that starts the first day of a new month. So he not only tells us when the first month occurs, but when the first day of a new month occurs, but he also tells us when each of the dates that he wants to meet with us occur based upon them being any number of days from that first month of the year. So it is a very clearly articulated calendar, and we were in our program yesterday discussing how we know when the first month of the year is based upon what God articulated in his Torah, and then when we know when each of these dates occurs. So it is all available to you. Now, there's one thing, Glenn, that will be a challenge, a potential challenge to you. You seem like you're an open-minded guy, and you seem like you generally want to know the truth, but you've identified yourself as a Christian. So I'm going to give you this one warning, one thing you ought to be really concerned about. The Torah is very easy to understand if you're open to God's testimony, but most religious individuals are not. Most religious individuals have a very negative view of Yahweh's Torah teaching because Pauline doctrine is the basis of the Christian religion. So the one thing you're going to want to do is to be willing to jettison much of what you have been taught as a Christian in your quest to understand Yahweh. So if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to let go of Christianity as you study Yah's Torah instructions, then it will be the most rewarding, the most beneficial, the most enjoyable time that you spent in this world. Is that helpful?
Am I still on the air? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Glenn. Okay, we have to go quickly, then we've got two other callers.
The book on the webpage, I'll look into that. I also wanted to, you can answer this another time at your leisure. My original question also was, as a Christian, of course, I have a tendency to emphasize the significance of the Torah and the Tanakh, but to de-emphasize the Talmud and Zohar and things like that. I'd be interested in hearing further where you stand on I'll drop off and let you go on.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Glenn. Before we listen to Rod's question and then go to Wayne in Texas, the answer is very clear on Rod's, excuse me, Glenn's last question. The Torah is foundational. The Torah is God's foundation. You can't get anywhere. You can't come to know God. You can't engage in a relationship with God. You can't be saved by God without coming to know and understand who God is and what he is offering in the Torah and responding to it. That God cannot be known. You can't engage in a relationship with him because the covenant is only presented in one place. God only introduces himself to us in one place. And he only provides the path to salvation in one place. Without the Torah, you've got nothing when it comes to God. So it's the place. Now, the prophets and Psalms all teach us a great deal about the Torah, and they contain God's Torah teaching in them. But the Torah is the place you've got to go. And as it relates to the Talmud and the Zohar and all of these other things, including the Christian New Testament, they don't have anything to do with God. They are men's ramblings and are mostly inaccurate. I would just ignore all of them. That said, Rod, welcome to the program. I understand you have a question or a comment on Passover.
I do, but before I get to that, I wanted to comment on what you've just been talking about, and that is the scriptures I have found don't say what they're supposed to say coming from a Christian background. I am 65 now, and back when I was about 14, I tried to read the Bible, scriptures, excuse me.
Yes, yeah.
And I found it didn't say what I thought it was supposed to say. And
yeah, that's right.
I didn't understand. And so what you're saying is certainly true, and our preconceived notions make it very difficult to.
Yeah, if you've been indoctrinated in Pauline doctrine, which is this idea that the Torah is laws that have to be obeyed, and Torah does not mean laws, it's teaching, and there is no Hebrew word for obey. and you listen to what God has to say about his instructions and his relationship and who he is and what he is offering us, it is completely inconsistent with the religion of Christianity. So if you come to the Torah from the Christian perspective, it's going to say the opposite of what you expect it to say. The God of Christianity has nothing in common with the real God that authored his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so if you're not willing to let go of your Christianity, you have no hope of coming to understand the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, or come to know Yahweh as he is, or engage in a covenant relationship. You've got to let go of one to embrace the other.
Okay, now to the comments about the Passover.
Yes.
I was listening to your Friday evening Sabbath program on Yada Yada Blog Radio.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the book of Habakkuk. I forget how you pronounce that in Hebrew. You were talking about Paul and his intoxicating wine, which jogged my memory.
Mm-hmm.
I got thinking, well, you know, I've had some serious questions about the bread and wine business.
Mm-hmm.
I assume this is what you do for Passover, to observe Passover, is take bread and wine.
Well, the primary ingredient for Passover is roasted lamb. And so, yeah, lamb, not boiled, but over fire. Barbecued lamb, if you will, in today's parlance. Lamb is the primary ingredient in Passover, but with that lamb, we're encouraged to eat bread without yeast, dipping it in bitter herbs. So those are the instructions, and the only reason that we sip wine is that Yahusha uses, and Yahweh both use wine as a metaphor in association with the Passover, because wine being the color of blood is Yah speaks of blood as being symbolic with life, and Passover is all about extending our lives. The doorway of Passover is about going from being mortal to immortal, and so the wine is symbolic of Passover. The bread, which is unleavened, is symbolic of unleavened bread, which is part of this triumphant of days that Yah is providing us with, that enable us to become immortal, become perfected by him, and to become adopted in his family. So the bread, the unleavened bread, and the wine are simply symbols, metaphors, if you will, for what's taking place during this time. And of course, the lamb is essential, because it's the lamb which is being sacrificed for us to live.
Okay, well, that's excellent. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I have a book that I bought over 15 years ago called The Jesus Mysteries.
Yeah.
And it talks extensively how the Jesus Christ of the New Testament is really a rehash of the mystery religions of the pagan man gods of Bacchus, Dionysus.
Yeah,
Cyrus.
Right. Rod, that's partially true, but not wholly true. It is true that the Jesus of Paul's letters is based entirely on Dionysus, who is the same as Bacchus, who's the same as Osiris, who's the same as Tammuz. In fact, it is the most famous line of Dionysus that Paul puts in his Jesus's mouth on the road to Damascus. You know, it's difficult to revolt or kick against the goat. That's Dionysus's most famous line for those who understand those mystery religions. And Paul's letters cast his Jesus Christ into the exact same constraint as the son of the sun in pagan religions, which would be Dionysus, Osiris, Tammuz, and Bacchus. And so that is correct. What isn't correct is that if you look at the eyewitness accounts of Matanyah and Yahochanan, their portrayal of the words and deeds of Yahusha do not in any way resemble the pagan gods and sun goddesses of the past. But the Christian Jesus, as he is understood in Christianity, is very, very similar to Dionysus, very similar to Bacchus, Osiris, and Tammuz.
Well, if anybody would like to have that from a source other than you, I would suggest that they get a copy of the Jesus Mysteries and read it.
Yep.
And it really does a thorough job of showing.
Yeah, that's the reason why when Yosha was talking to anyone that that asked a question to him about how do you know who he is and understand him, he always said, if you want to understand me, you need to turn to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. If you turn to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, if you read God's instructions from beginning to end, you know that Yosha walked right out of the pages of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He was the living manifestation of the Torah. He lived, talked, and observed Torah. And so if you come to know Yahusha as the living manifestation of the Torah, everything he did and said makes sense. But if you come to view him from the backwards view that Paul provides, then what you end up having is a relationship with one of the sun god deities of old. It's kind of like the football player from Notre Dame that had a love affair with an imaginary girlfriend. Well, Christians are having an imaginary relationship with an imaginary character.
Yep, that's right.
And so that's the problem of Christianity. It is it has almost everything in common with the Babylonian religion of old, including Christmas and Easter and Sunday worship and the Trinity, and you name it. It just goes on and on and on. Almost every aspect of Christianity is pagan in its origins, and that's why the Torah seems so alien to Christians. Because the real Yahusha, who observed the Torah, who upheld the Torah, who lived the Torah, would be as alien to them as well. Rob, thank you for your question. Wayne calling in from Texas. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Wayne, who is calling in from Texas and has a question on the second day of Matzah. Hello, Wayne. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Yada. Thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you.
I did have a question because I've read several places and in the Torah, you know, the first and seventh day of Matzah are considered high Sabbaths or set-apart gatherings.
Shabbatons.
Huh?
Shabbatons.
Yeah.
Shabbaton is a derivative of Shabbat. You know, Shabbat means in Hebrew both seven and promise. And so it is God's promise that is conveyed to us through the number seven. The number seven is the ideal result. You know, if you look at man was created on the sixth day, plus God who is one, together we equate to God's promise of being together, which is God's version of perfection. That's what seven represents. So a Shabbaton is based on the Hebrew word Sabbath, which means promise, and seven, and it is a special Sabbath, the Shabbaton, that they are observed the same way as the seventh day of the week, but they could fall on any day of the week.
Right.
Okay.
I've read your Intro to God and a lot of other yada yada material.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm curious about is the second day of Matzah, the first fruits deal. And where the instruction for that comes from.
Yeah, God provides us a review of Bukhutim throughout his Torah. So it is true that you really have to dig more deeply to understand Bukhutim than you do Matzah. And it's kind of interesting here, too, in that with Pesach, Passover, in this presentation of the seven times of the year that we're to meet with the Yahweh, you know, he doesn't describe anything associated with Passover in the Kara Leviticus. You have to go elsewhere to learn the how to observe and what the purpose and the meaning is of Passover. The same thing is really true with Bukhutim. It's not as completely delineated in this presentation. One of the things I'm going to do, though, here in about 4 or 5 days, is I'm going to begin an entire week-long series just on the information related to Bukhutim. And typically, with any one of these days, the simplest answer, Wayne, is to, you know, how do you learn about what Bukhutim represents, is to look at the vocabulary that Yahweh used.
Yeah.
Bukhutim is the plural of Bakar. And Bakar means firstborn child. And so the purpose of Bukhutim is defined by its name. that once we become immortal, as it relates to Pesach Passover, and our souls are unleavened of the fungus of the corrupting fungus of sin on matzah, we are prepared to become bakar, children born into God's family. God only has one family, so it's the covenant family.
Well, I have heard that of first fruits before, but I have always associated it with what they call Pentecost.
Oh, no, that's Shabuah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Shabuah is the Christian notion of Pentecost. Pentecost is 50 in Greek. And if you look at Shabuah, Shabuah is 7 times 7 days plus one from matzah, which means it's 7 times 7 days, 49 days from first fruits, from Bukurim, or 50 days from matzah. And that's why it's called Pentecost, which is 50 in Greek.
Okay.
The purpose of Shabuah is also defined by its name. Shabuah is seven sevens. It means, so Shabuah is seven sevens. It's either, you can refer to it as 7 weeks, seven Sabbaths, sevens, Sabbaths, but Shabuah is seven sevens. And so it is, again, it's emphasizing the two aspects of seven that are important.
Right.
One is God's promise that we are together, and the second is that he has given us his promise. But what you find on Shabuah, and there's a lot of information on it, and as we approach Shabuah, I promise to do a whole series of 5 or 6 shows on it. But to understand it, you really have to dig into the Hebrew to understand its concepts. And what you learn when you do so, something that I've really come to learn, Wayne, just quite recently. So when we present Shabuah, I'm going to be sharing information that may be even new to you if you've read the Shabuah chapter, which is that it appears that Shabuah is really about two things. It deals with the last two benefits of the covenant, which are we're enriched by Yahweh and we're empowered by Yahweh. We're enriched by Yahweh, something that he tells us that he's going to do on his return, which he writes his Torah inside of us. In other words, he helps us understand his teaching, which enriches us, and he empowers us with his spirit. And so we'll spend considerable more time on Shabuah. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our program today.